automatic doors for kitchen. And that is probably about 20.
Okay, much of that was pretty noisy, Hugo. Much of that was pretty noisy. However, there was one spot when you said, I'm walking toward the kitchen. It was the best spot. One of the things I do recommend, Hugo, if you haven't already done so, any little old coat hanger antenna made out of an SO239 connector, fed with a piece of RG58 cable or better, hung up on the chimney of the house or on the second floor of your house, and then come down to a BNC connector so that when you're sitting at your favorite operating position, you can disconnect the rubber duck and connect the outside antenna. That will make you 20 decibels stronger or even more. It's the extra altitude that's doing it. So sometime downrange, I recommend you do that. But you were a little bit noisy through the machines. Well, you were very noisy throughout much of that walk, except when you said, I'm starting to walk toward the kitchen. I was listening both on the input and the output at that time, and there are places where you go through the machine much better, and you get a dropout to me on the direct path and vice versa. So back to you. Let's see if you've got a good location before you give us the question. W2IGH, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, for those who are not hearing him on the input, and I am, Hugo is about to go to a hot rod antenna, and he told us to stand by while he makes the change.
Antenna up above my chimney and the Diamond SX-77 antenna, and I can do that within a few seconds. If you have a S-meter, you can give us an idea about, particularly if you're listening directly, about how much of a difference it makes. Shall I do that? Over to you.
Wow, what an improvement. Whatever you're using right now, don't change it. You're coming through the machine, dead full quieting, and you're giving me an S9 signal here at my shack, whereas before you were S1. So whatever you're doing right now, leave it that way and go right ahead with your question, Hugo. And do tell me once again, I think you said you went to a hot rod antenna, or this is an antenna on the roof. Whatever you're doing now, you are 20 decibels stronger into the machine and into me. W2IGH, K2RIW.
Yes, I know. I'm for sure that this will do it, because that is the telescope antenna. You know, they used to call it the hot rod antenna, but that is much better. You know, I just put that instead of the rubber duck. Now, the question I had was, maybe somebody was on the net who has also a 202. I think I know what it is. I get a display when I go on there that says RT and a 4R and then a 1. And on the internet, there's
thank you. I'm not sure, Hugo, if you passed it over to me or not. The transmission you made where I told you how strong you were and how good you sounded, I was seeing a lot of signal on the input, and you were very good to the machine. And I hear tell you were running on the telescoping antenna. Then I think you moved to another location, or you sat down, you made some kind of a change. The next transmission, when you started giving me the question about the ER1, we heard about the first 20 seconds of your transmission, and then your Radio Shack 202 just transmitted a steady, low-frequency tone after that. Maybe the battery is running down. I know that the Radio Shack handy-talkie, when it starts seeing a low battery, sometimes it goes into a peculiar mode where when you let go of the switch, it won't go out of the transmit mode back to the receive mode. So I wonder if you're running on a low battery with your Radio Shack 202, and I wonder from that good transmission with the new telescoping antenna if you made some change on the next transmission. Back to you, Hugo, and maybe you changed the battery by now if that's what it was. W2IGH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
How do I come in there now, Dick?
Fantastic. Now, once again, you're extremely strong. What did you do between the first and the second transmission that made it so much weaker? And what did you just do now for the third? Back to you, Hugo.
Well, what I did was, for some reason, and I think it may be low battery, the thing stopped, you know. I may have a low battery in there. So what I did was, I'm on a different unit now, a 2500. It's actually an old unit there, a Kenwood 2500. And I put it on there, and there I have a power supply for it. So this won't happen again. But that's what happened, Dick. So I should be coming fine through there now.
Someone says comment, but your signal is extremely weak. Right now, you're 20 over 9, Hugo. That rig is a lot happier rig. So go ahead with your question, Hugo.
The only question I had was if anybody else had gotten this with a, if anybody had the, Radio Shack, realistic, I guess. They called it 202, HDX 202, and whether they had come up against that problem of a low lithium battery, where it actually, I think it gives you the display. And it gives you a beep tone that is repetitive about one every 2 seconds or so. And it shows, displays a capital E and a small R, and then a 1. I think it's ERL or ER1. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think that probably means low battery. I know that a Radio Shack HTX 202, when the battery goes down, does start behaving in a peculiar way. I've heard people talk about the audio disappearing, and we heard that on your transmission. I've heard people talk about it staying in the transmit mode even when you stop pressing the push-to-talk button. So the HTX 202 does have a couple of conditions like that. Now, there was a person who said comment and said that twice. The person who said comment, why don't you give me your call letters and your name right now, and let's find out who you are. Comment person, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, the call is Whiskey Kilowatt, 2 Delta, double D, case to be the name of John. How's that?
Whiskey Kilowatt, 2 Delta, John. A little bit noisy, but I'm copying you both on the input and the output, so go right ahead with your comment, John.
Okay, Dick. What he has to do is, when that radio goes to ER1, it's because the backup, the lithium battery, the backup battery is low, so he'll put it into ER1. What he has to do is hold the F and the D key. F and the D key, hold them both down, and turn the radio on. So in other words, when he's holding the F and D down, the radio is off. So he holds F and D, turns on the radio, and it'll take it out of error.
And when it's in the ER1 mode, or error 1 mode, John, What does that mean? I think you said it's on the backup lithium battery, and it's not using the ordinary battery, and does it go to a much lower power output? Is that what happens, John? Go ahead.
Yes, that's what it is. The backup battery, the lithium battery in the radio. Every once in a while that happens, but it does what I said with the key. That'll straighten it out. Now, why it don't go back in error, I'm not sure. Maybe this, with the radio on, it helps it out. They don't give you too much information on that in the book. It's definitely in the book.
HTX-202?
It is an HTX-202 we're talking about. So I wonder if that all made sense to you, Hugo. So what John is suggesting is you turn that HTX-202 off, hold down the F and the D key, that's what he said, I think that's Foxtrot and Delta key, and then turn it on, and that takes it out of the error mode where it's been using the lithium battery. W2IGH, need a fill on that, Hugo? K2RIW on the TechNet?
That is exactly what I did. I did hold down the F key, then put down the and hold down the D key. He's exactly right. That's what I did, and it does reset it. It does reset it, and I can program it and everything, but it does not last long. So therefore, I think it's just the lithium battery is long. You see, it doesn't last long. It will reset it, and I can reprogram it. But then if I wait maybe for 10 minutes or maybe a little longer and turn it on, it goes back to the ER1L mode. So that means I think that the battery is very low, and I have to just replace that lithium battery. So back to you. He's exactly right. That does do it. So back to you, Dick.
MAR with a comment.
Okay, Mr. MAR, I think it is. Give us your full call letters and your name, and then go ahead with your comment.
Hello, Bravo 2, Mike House, Romeo, in here is Gabe. I replaced the lithium battery, my HTX-202 myself, and it requires losing much milk to stop the soldering. It's one of those batteries that has a solder tab solder to the battery itself. Cooled in a little bit. It's a little bit difficult to put in. Now the problem is, when I ordered the battery about a couple of years ago, they said they only had two left. Now I don't know if they just continue making the battery, the custom 58 key, or maybe they just ran out and ordered some more. So, worst comes to worst, I believe it's a 2032 size from what I remember. Maybe you can get one of the little holders and, you know, make it stick. There is quite a bit of space. So if the holder adds more thickness to the area, you should be able to, you know, you put some electrical tape around it so it won't short out anything. Maybe two MAR back to that.
Okay, KB2MAR, I think it is. Gabe. So I guess the lithium battery, you tried buying it from Radio Shack, and I think you said they only had two of them left a year ago. To your knowledge, I think you said if you're willing to go to twice the thickness, you can find something that's got a holder that'll take a battery without tabs. Do you know of any other place where Hugo would be able to get the lithium battery with the tabs on it, which makes the replacement a little bit easier? Any other suggestions on that one, Gabe? KB2MAR, I think it is. K2RIW on the TechNet.
I looked around myself, I couldn't find one, but I think if they do this, I suggest it to myself, so this is a Radio Shack because it's the original is OEM part, so it's not going to fit for sure, there's no tooling and things like that, so I just went that route. It looks like the battery itself has like a plastic ring around the edges, so it won't short out to the end of the part and things like that, and of course it has a soft tab on it. If you go in the Mauser catalog, they should have those batteries to have under the stuff already. So if you want, maybe contact the major lithium manufacturer like Mauser, and get it in the catalog.
KB2MAR, KQRIWI. Gabe, you were only in there 60% of the time. Lots and lots of dropouts. Your signal is a bit weak into the machine tonight. But I think Hugo heard your suggestion that the Mauser catalog might have a substitute if you can't get it from Radio Shack. The main thing that that lithium battery has to do, Gabe, as you, Hugo, as you probably know, is to provide the right voltage. I'm going to guess it's something like a 3.2-volt battery. One way or another, you're going to be able to find a battery of approximately the same physical size at the same voltage output, and even if it's a slightly different configuration, it sure would be nice if it had the solder tabs on it so you could do a direct replacement. But by way of the Mauser catalog or other catalogs, I'll bet you you will find a lithium battery that is close to the same size at approximately the same voltage, and that's all the radio really needs. Is there something that will fit in there that has the right voltage and approximately the same milliampere hours. The lithium battery, I think in most radios, is only the backup battery, making sure you don't lose memory. And so, for the most part, it's not supplying any real power like your main battery is. Anyone have any further suggestions on the replacement lithium battery for an HTX202 handy talkie? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? I heard somebody say K2, and that's all. They dropped out. We'll come back to try to pick up the other person after Rich. N2EO, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, just a suggestion. That radio was a copy of the one of the ICOM radios. I forget the model number of the ICOM. A lot of people think the radio was made by ICOM. They copied it. The radio was made in South Korea by another company that took the ICOM, the IC2. I can't remember the number on that radio, but they sort of made parts upon a Chinese copy of it. He might be able to use the battery that ICOM uses in their radio, because a lot of the accessories, for instance, that radio takes ICOM batteries. It was sort of copied around the ICOM. That's my suggestion, Dick. Back to that.
Yeah, that may be a good one. If he calls up the service center of ICOM in, I can't think of the name of the town, in Oregon, the service center of ICOM is very helpful on ICOM equipment, and where the HTX202 is a South Korean copy, there's a 50-50 chance that the service person of ICOM will still help you and sell you the part that will fix an HTX202 if Radio Shack is no longer able to supply it. And I know it's not the IC2AT, because the 2AT does not have any kind of memory inside. It's all some real switch, and there's no memories at all. So there is no lithium battery on that one. But there's a whole slew of ICOM radios, and so I'll bet you the service department knows which one is the Korean copy. Anyone with any further suggestions for where Hugo can get the lithium battery for his HTX202, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2EWK, take down this information, please. ICOM is the telephone number. I hope you had your pencil and paper or crayon. ICOM is 1-800-872-4266. 1-800-872-4266.
USL? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'll do that. I'll try that. Thank you very much.
And Bernie, let's hear from you. K2YO. Bernie, we got that information, Eugene. And Bernie, go right ahead.
I had some success with, I believe it's called W&W batteries in Hicksville. I have some older ICOM 2SAT type radios. I got an R1 and a number of them of that format, and they have an internal battery pack. And when I dug them out, the battery packs were all dead, and I called W&W, and they made a pack specifically for that. So I would highly recommend give them a call. You'll probably pay a little bit extra because it's a local, you know, bricks and mortar supplier. But it's very likely they would have one in that configuration. Or if you take the pack out, take the pack to them, I'd be willing to bet they could make you one in that configuration. It's just a matter of having the batteries and the right tab configuration. And they can, you know, they've got the machinery to deal with all that. So just my thought, it's called W&W Batteries, I believe. I know how to physically get there. I think it's right across from the old Grumman plant. Maybe somebody else will know better contact information for me.
Good information, Bernie. The slight error, though, is that you're supplying information for the main battery pack that powers the radio. And right now, we have reason to believe that it's the lithium backup battery that's soldered to the printed circuit board is the one that Hugo has to replace. So we're looking for that one. But even there, WW might be able to help. Anyone with any further suggestions, give us a call. Let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Back to K2L.
Go ahead, Bernie.
That's the negative. That was not the external pack. Those are internal cells. Inside the 2SAT had an internal battery. And they were, I'm trying to think of how they were connected. I think they were physically wired to the circuit board, but they were internal to the radio, so I think they may still have it.
So are you saying, Bernie, that the lithium battery backup is not just one cell, it is more than one cell, it's a kind of a battery pack, so to speak? Back to you, Bernie.
Specifically in a 2SAT it is. I don't know about the Radio Shack units. I haven't had one of those apart. But in my particular instance, it was a multi-cell pack. But the radios were designed to be able to run without an external battery, so it was a quasi-external battery shoved inside the case. But that was what, basically, once those failed on the radio, then the radio wouldn't function anymore.
Okay, sounds like some pretty good information. Alrighty, earlier a person who signed in with a question was Paul, Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform, but Paul, when we back to him a few minutes later, wasn't available. Paul, if you're there, why don't you give us a response right now?
K2JJ with battery info.
Okay, let me first find out if Paul is there, and then we'll pick you up, Doug. Paul, are you there? Sure sounds like Paul really got called away. Doug, go right ahead.
Alrighty, Dick, very good evening. It's a standard lithium battery they use in the 202s and the 404s. It's a CR2032, 2032. It's a 3-volt lithium coin cell, a very standard bat. You want to try to find one with the solder tabs. So you have to shop around for that. But that is the battery. It's a CR2032.
Good information, CR2032. And do not attempt to solder tabs on there yourself. There's a whole lot of reasons why you shouldn't do that. Lithium batteries are kind of vulnerable to excess heat and things like that. So I'm pretty sure what the manufacturer does is have a spot welding machine that puts on those tabs. It's not an ordinary solder connection. Have you seen those solder tab version of CR2032 batteries in any other catalog, Doug, like a Mauser or whatever? Go ahead.
No, I haven't, Dick, off the top of my head, but as I say, that's a very standard battery. I think typically they go in those coin cell holders, which have the tabs on them, you know, those spring-loaded devices. And there is plenty of room in that HD to put one in. So, you know, if he comes up with a holder for that battery, it's very standard, and, you know, you can solder it right in there. There's plenty of room.
That sounds like a good suggestion. And then in the future, there's no problem getting a CR2032 battery. My guess is it's a standard product in Home Depot and Radio Shack and places like that. Lowe's, they probably have those batteries are ready to roll, the ones without the tabs. And if you switch it into the, if you flip it into the coin cell holder, the whole problem goes away. thank goodness we're no longer using batteries with dynamic RAM. I mean, radios with dynamic RAM, like, occurred for a short period of time back there, well, I guess 15 or so years ago, where when the battery goes dead, you lose all the programming of the rig and all the buttons on the front panel became inert. Boy, did that make people angry. Thank goodness that was only a short-lived technique for building radios. Okay, you guys are listening to TechNet number 1184 of the series that began way back in 1982. Anyone else with any questions or comments on any of the above or a new subject, give me your mentor and me and Mel your call letters right now. K2LIW listening.
M2EO Dick,
we
have a very simple question.
K2RIW, this is Whiskey Victor, 2 uniform, name is Paul. Yes.
Okay, Rich recognized with a simple question, and Paul did come back. We gave a few calls for you, Paul. Maybe you had one of those emergency phone calls. I know what they're like. Whiskey Victor 2 uniform, you got it, Paul.
Thank you very much, Dick. Look, my question concerns a topic you brought up a couple of weeks back of an RF shadow. I sometimes do some satellite work, and my 432 receive is interfered with because of a cable vision cable directly to my northeast. So anytime I point my antenna to the northeast, any of the satellite signals are usually overridden by the cable signal. I'm wondering if it's possible for me to cast an RF shadow at 432 using a simple dipole or something to block RF from that direction and hopefully improve my tracking.
Okay. I can see what you're trying to do, Paul, and what you're trying to do is very difficult. One of the very good piece of news, which I sort of said it left-handedly in the March issue of CQ Ham Radio, CQ Amateur Radio Magazine, the magic of wireless is that once a radio signal is issued, it goes everywhere. And to stop it from going everywhere is very, very difficult. For you to put some kind of a shield between you and that cable vision leaking signal is not impossible, but for darn difficult, I wouldn't recommend that you try. A much better approach is to try to get the Cablevision to fix the leaking connector. That signal that you're hearing outside of that cable absolutely, positively should not be there. The connectors, if they're properly installed, have got 120 decibels of shielding, and unless you've got a very sensitive antenna 1 inch away from that connector, you shouldn't be able to hear anything. Every cable company must meet something called the CLI, Cumulative Leakage Index. Once per month, by FCC rules and FAA rules, they are supposed to reconfirm that none of their connectors are leaking. See, a good cable system that runs on coaxial cable, not the modern-day fiber, but the coaxial cable system is running something like 14 individual amplifiers per mile of cable in order to overcome the insertion loss of the cable to keep all the signals at the right signal strength. And each of those amplifiers are running about the 1 watt level. So there's a lot of power and a lot of amplifiers and a lot of locations on a lot of cables around a town. The total amount of power in that system is huge. So if an aircraft was flying over, let me drop. Some of the frequencies being used inside of that cable fall on amateur frequencies, they fall on television frequencies, they fall on FAA frequencies. So if an airplane is flying over a town, and if 30 of those connectors, there's thousands of connectors in the town, but if 30 of those connectors are all leaking the same signal at the same time, I don't have to tell you that that airplane is going to see an awful lot of signal, and it may jam their communication and navigation system. So that's the reason for this cumulative leakage index specification that every cable system must meet. In fact, if you simply Google the word cumulative leakage index, write that in as a search word. You'll get all kinds of information about what the levels are, how often they've got to be confirmed, what FCC rules and FAA rules, and so on. So once you identify by walking around with your handy talkie or whatever that can pick up the leakage from that signal, from that connector, once you recognize what connector it is, what pole is located on, so to speak, and inform your cable company, you could say by law that they're forced to fix it. So as I see it, Paul, you're way ahead of the game to stop the problem at the source, which is a leaking connector or a poor connection. Or I guess there's a slam possibility that somebody is running an inadvertent antenna in their house. There have been people who take the cable vision signal that comes into their house, adapt it to twin lead, and then run the twin lead under the rug to two or three different sets in the house, and with some tacks holding the twin lead in the right spot, they end up making an antenna that does radiating, if you know what I mean. So there's a slim possibility that the signal is radiating from somebody's home, but more likely the much higher level is the signal level at the cable itself that goes down the messenger cable that goes down the telephone poles, the utility poles. So I'm recommending you find out which connector and then try to get the cable vision to fix it. It's not going to happen immediately. At one time, somebody did bring to our attention the telephone number of a person. I guess that was at Long Island Lighting, Long Island Power Authority. There was a LIPA person who was very, very good at solving interference problems. I'd like to believe that there is a similar person at a Cablevision of Nassau that can also solve that problem. Back to you, Paul. Drag your feet a little bit in case someone else wants to give us additional information on this one. Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform with a little bit of delay. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Info in 2EO.
Go ahead, Rich.
Dick, maybe you forgot, I had a big battle with Time Warner Cable, I guess about 7-8 years ago. I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he's still there, but I contacted the New York State Cable Commission. The person in charge at that time was a hand. And it really went to town on Time Warner. They got fined. And any time they called Time Warner to answer a particular supervisor, they put me right through like a VIP. But I remember the guy from the Cable Commission told me to check two frequencies. I was on the phone with him. He told me to check, I think it's 140, 144 or 145 or 144, 250. It was 144, 145, and another frequency, which you all think is used by the amateur television enthusiast, 439.25. Those are two channels in the cable system that fall within the ham pin. When I told them that I was picking them up real loud, they went to work on Time Warner. In fact, the FCC, and they don't come out for anything. They come out to my prop. I wasn't here at the time, but they got back to me. They wanted to get into the backyard to do a field strength reading. And they told me they couldn't get into the backyard because the gate was locked. They took a reading at the gate. They were pushed by the New York State Cable Commission because they were radiating on the FAA frequencies, and Time Warner got a big fine. So I don't know if this ham, I don't remember his name or call, it's going back a long time, but I would suggest he contact the New York State Cable Commission.
Very good, Rich. Nice information. As I see it, Paul, looks to me like you've got a lot of federal agencies and state agencies on your side to stop the interference at the source. Because not only is it giving you grief, but quite potentially it is a hazard to air navigation for the FAA aircraft that fly over your town. WV2U, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, WV2U. Well, Dick, I want to thank you very much for your sage advice as always.
and I guess Rich was in there, and thank you, Rich. I think I will check with the state cable people to see if I can get some attention there. I guess now I'm going to have to study the interference a little bit more than I was hoping to, but should be no problem. I can tune up the satellite rig on CW and see if it can pick up a dead carrier and what frequencies I can find it on. So maybe I can take that information and start there and either call Cablevision or go directly to the state. I guess I should try the Cablevision first and then try the state afterwards if they don't give me any satisfaction. Although I was kind of nervous about my neighbor kind of in the same direction. He's got a son who has tried to help him out some. And I think I've seen him splice into the cable to run into other TVs and not using a balun or anything. I don't know what he did. Maybe just straight Twinly twisted onto the coax from Cablevision. And I would hate to cause an incident for him, so I might have to go check with him to see if that bad splice is potentially the trouble spot.
Yes. I'm almost sure that the frequency that cable companies use for a video carrier, and I think it's their cable channel 13 or 21, some number, 727, is 145.25. Each cable system has got a slight difference on this one. Some of them are 145.24, sometimes are 145.25 or 145.26, either 10kc up or 10kc down from 145.25. But that is a frequency that most cable companies do use, and your handy talkie might very well copy that one. Therefore, you can walk around that neighbor's house, walk near those cable systems, and find out really where the leakage is coming from, where it's the strongest. That's probably easier to tune than 439.25. I sure wish that your handy talkie had single sideband capability, because when you listen to a tone in the noise, you can hear a much weaker tone, and you can nearly you can tell when it's getting stronger and weaker. With an FM handy talkie, 145.25, it's a little bit more difficult to judge when you're getting full quieting from the signal. Well, then again, it's a video modulated signal, which has got a characteristic sound to it, so even over an FM radio, you're going to hear that. So you could do troubleshooting, you know, bunny hunting, so to speak, fox hunting, with a handy talkie, in my opinion. That way you may find out that the house is not doing it with the modified wiring. Because the actual drop, as it's called, in other words, the connection of the wire that goes to the person's house with the cable vision signal, that is on a 20 or 30 decibel directional coupler. In other words, that signal coming into the house is quite a bit weaker than the signal that goes down the main three-quarter inch or seven-eighths inch diameter hardline cable that goes down the utility pole. That's the strong signal. So if one of those connectors becomes leaky, that's much more likely to radiate a signal than to radiate a signal from a private home. So as you investigate this one further, Paul, please come back and keep us informed. Even good news or bad news, as it goes, because your problem, I guarantee you're not alone. There are other amateurs who would like to know what finally you discover and what finally is the solution. WV2U, K2LIW in the TechNet.
W2EO.
It's Firefly, what I'm answering is that. Okay, Paul and another person, I mean Rich and another person in that order. Rich first, go ahead.
Okay, I remember the fellow from the Cable Commission told me some of the signals you pick up, like the oral carrier 4.5 megs down from the video, they don't appear in the normal place because the cable companies use compression. They use compression on their system. So things appear in different spots than you would normally expect. I remember when they had to clean up my neighborhood, they had to change. They had a big job, so the New York State Cable Commission and the FCC really came down on Time Warner. I think mainly because I'm right within the flight path. one of your airports. I know they have, they came down with trucks, they have to change all the Stinger connectors, they have to redo drops, etc., etc.
Fantastic. Who's the other person who has some information?
Yeah, Bill, KB1IFY in Stanford. I've had the same problem over here since Cablevision changed the channels. Channel 18 is on the same frequency as the 145.25. I notice with my HT, if I put it on 143.750, I can pick up the channel 17. It radiates as clear as a bell. I have a neighbor. What they did was they wired up the house using 59 instead of RGU6, and it's radiating. The closer I get to their house, the stronger the signal gets. You might want to try that around his house, too. Put his HT on 143.750 and see if he can pick up channel 17 off his cable. KB1IFY, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Bill. If he's picking up 143.750 and another frequency guys pick up frequently is 145.25, that's only 2 megs away. It doesn't sound like one channel away. So just like Rich is telling us, the cable system does have some funny offset frequencies. So you were able to pick up a strong signal, 143.750. Were you picking up audio or video in your opinion, Bill? Go ahead.
Oh, definitely the audio. No doubt about it, it was the audio. But that's how I kind of troubleshot it, and I kind of determined. I've been on Cablevision, the repair industry, for years, and you know, they gave me the golden handshake, as you say.
I understand. So, how did you eventually get solution to it, Bill?
I didn't. I don't use 2 meters that often, but when I do, that's their problem. They were harassing me, these people, for the longest time, saying it was my radio and this, that, and the other, but yet they wouldn't let Cablevision enter their house to repair the problem.
Okay, so the problem was in a private home, I see. And, but even that is making the system exceed the cumulative leakage index for the FCC and FAA ratings. So I'm sure there is got to be a way that if a private home is doing the radiating, there's got to be a way of forcing that particular customer to stop doing it. With proper with proper pressuring, I guess Cablevision could threaten that customer with discontinuing their service if they didn't make improvement to the installation in that particular home. What do you think about that one, Bill? Go ahead.
Well, I tell you what, I wish they would do that so they get the problem fixed and it wouldn't be a headache anymore. But no, if anybody has any solutions or anything, comes up with any answers, they can always email me. It's my call, kb1ify@yahoo.com. If anybody's, you know, has anything that they can add to it or whatever, they're welcome to do that. Back to you, Dick, KB1IFY.
Thank you for the information, Bill. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on this particular subject or any other subject, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Dick, I have a question. Put me down. Let somebody else go ahead, and then I have a question. I'm trying. Very simple question. I think Mel can answer.
Okay, let's make sure now. Have we run out of questions and comments from everyone? Sure sounds like we have. In which case, you're number one on the runway, Rich.
Okay, Dick, and to Leo. You know, I got into this Collins thing. I have Mel replaced for that. But we have three Collins setups here, KWM2A, 75A4 and an R390. Eventually, I hope to get a KWS1 transmitter and maybe a 30S1 amplifier. I wanted to know, I don't know if Mel is on frequency or maybe somebody else knows, the serial number, I forget the exact number, but it's the 38,000 on the KWM2. Does anybody know exactly how many KWM2As they made? In other words, I'm trying to figure out about when a 38,000 serial number was manufactured. And all same ditto for the 75A4. There are, I think they made about 6,000. Mine is just a little below 3,000, like 200, 2998, I think is the serial number. But I'm really curious on the M2. This is one of the later ones. It has the dial brake on it, the lever that you flip lock brake to lock the PTO. It's a round emblem.
$38,000.
Anybody have an idea when
that
was manufactured?
I'll bet you.
Okay,
go
right
ahead, Bill.
Rich, best one to go to is the Collins Collectors Net, or online, go to Google Collins Collectors. They'll give you all the information, whatever there is available. They have all the documents. There's a problem with the KWM2 because the KWM2-2A series, most of it was made for military, a great deal of it went to military and to the Allies. And somebody once said to me that there was a lot of confusion because they did break off a number of reasons that they bounced around the serial numbers and all. I don't know what that reason was, whether or not because of some secret project, or who knows what Collins got themselves involved with. But it's a good possibility that the Collector's Net may be able to give you a little bit more information on it. My Collins 84, remember, the serial number on my 84, I think it's 5125, I believe, Rich, over.
Yours is right near the end of the run. Mine, I guess, is in the middle, a little below 3,000. Am I correct on the A4s? They made about 6,000, and I believe it was 1955 to 1958 now.
Roger. My system, came as one station, the KWS-1. N75A4 was 1957 because I remember standing in Harrison and looking at it with the desk and the whole console business and with the whole work, the whole schmear, as they say, including that painting in the background. If you look at the Collins Collector's logbook, you see that winter scene in the back, and that became a priceless item that, well, whole story why I don't have it anymore. But that was 1957, so it was close to the end of the run. I assume that let's put it this way. The KWS-1s, there was a total of a little over 2,000, I believe, were made. And I remember somebody mentioning to me about 900 wound up in amateur radio hands, I believe. The rest went to the military, Rich, over.
K2JJ.
Okay, well, very good, thank you. And Doug, I want to thank you for that information you mailed me, K2JJ. I should have turned it back to Dick, but Pat, turn it back to Dick, thank you.
Not to worry, you got it, Doug. Alrighty, Rich, very good. Glad you got it okay. That information on the A4 is on the money. As far as the M2As and the M2s, approximately 24,000, Rich, as far as they know. The serial numbers really, I don't think, mean anything. They were kind of staggered and encrypted and such. A lot of those were military, and a lot of those were used also in embassies. So as near as they can tell, approximately 24,000 were made, and on the A4 is about 6,000. So that's as far as we can tell. Back to that K2JJ.
What a piece of history. And so sounds to me like you're becoming a reasonably serious collector of Collins equipment. Is that true, Rich?
I would say so, Dick. You know, I'm 58. When I was 17 or 18, I wanted Collins. I couldn't afford it. But now I can afford it. The prices have gone up. It's actually, it held its value. The 75A4 in 1955 was about $600 or $500. they're going for 8-900 in unrestored condition, and AWM-2 is $1,500-1,700 bucks for a good one. Good condition, round them one. You can get a weak them one, older one, about 800. So they're still holding their value and they're going up. I guess it's supply and demand. I wanted to ask Doug or Mel, or maybe Doug, you can answer. There's another number besides the serial number called MCN number. Do you know what that is, and does that help pin it down?
Not familiar with that one, Rich. No, I can't help you there, KTJJ.
Tell ya.
Go ahead, Bill.
The NCN number was a special part of the military. I believe they used the military encryption number, and that's why you can't go by the serial number. That Doug is 100% right. The KWM-2A, you've got to remember, was used for the number of secret operations. Of the most secret operation that the M2A was used in communications was aboard the U-2 spy plane. If you remember that incident with the U-2 spy plane, they had the KWM-2A as their HF communications on it. So what they did, Collins was very tight-lipped on how they forced it around, but that NCN number was a military acquisition system, and I don't know if the files were ever declassified or what happened with it. Now, in 1957, when you mentioned the KWS-1A4 series, the one I have at all, the complete console at that time with the station controller, the 51J, all mode receiver at the time, and the whole business and everything was $7,200. That was the complete station. I think I have the original bill of sale and everything in my files, because I bought it from the estate of my friend, who's also my teacher in Brooklyn Tech, Tracy Sears, that owned that station previously. So I have all that paperwork on it, Rich, over.
Okay, very interesting. See, these rings have real historical value. It's very, very interesting. By the way, I was able to get a brand new, in the box, never used, 136B2 noise blanket for this M2. And they're not installed in there. So, I guess a piece of history. And Dick, just to reiterate, you know, the prices keep going up on this stuff. I mean, I'm not buying it, but there's a guy advertising in the Collins Collectors Association. He's got what Mel has there, the KWS-1, which is a 1 kilowatt sideband transmitter, and the matching receiver, which I have here, the 7584. For the pair, he says perfect mint condition, Collins Collectors quality. And we're talking about stuff made in the 50s, which is still excellent equipment. He wants $6,500. Go ahead, Dick.
That's a collector's item, and it looks like it's actually a business investment for some people. How about that? And I have heard that during the Vietnam War, an awful lot of ham radio equipment was proving to be more reliable than the equipment that was being built specifically for military application. Doesn't surprise me. Anyone have any further questions or comments? Or Paul, WS2N, if he's available, give me your call letters right now. K2RI to be listening.
Yeah, just one more comment, K2RI.
Okay, yeah. Mel, recognize who is the other person?
Bill, WD2CUK.
Okay, Bill, we're going to get to you right after Mel. Mel first, go ahead.
During the Vietnam War, all I saw was equipment we had over there, and I got involved in the situation. I won't get into it now because it's quite lengthy, about taking a Collins setup, the S-line setup, and moving it to a embassy where actually there wasn't any mostly American troops other than embassy personnel, because at that time Johnson was president, insisted on keeping that embassy open in Cambodia. But when I got there, I found out that the radio room had been blown up, and what was left there was some remains of an F-line. So basically, we replaced that F-line there, and I had used to listen, of course, to get on amateur radio frequency, which was basically somewhat illegal, to say the least. But the F-line was the backbone of radio communication in the 60s. And in fact, that's how I got involved with everything, because I went in there. In fact, I was a CW instructor initially, became an officer, and then wound up installing, servicing, and keeping Collins F-lines moving along, Dick. And they had a lot of them there, over.
Fascinating. Bill, are you also a collector of Collins equipment? WB2CUK, K2RIW?
No, Dick, I haven't collected it, but I have used it in the past. When I was in the Air Force, their Mars station had a beautiful set of Collins. I don't remember the number, but the whole system, receiver, transmitter, and everything, and really beautiful. I have a question for you. I was listening to you talking about cable, and in relation to that, I'd like to know, and I'm curious, no one has been really talking about it, except on TV, about this, the TV going all digital. On an older set, let's say you had one that you could tune variably across the TV band, what do you think the signal's going to look like and sound like in the digital mode? I'm just curious about this.
You can find out real fast, Bill, right where you live. Tune to channel 55, which right now is digital. And by the way, there are a zillion digital channels out there. Your set will show absolutely nothing. As far as your set is concerned, that's just broadband noise. You tune to it with a spectrum analyzer, you see broadband noise. I haven't actually listened to it with a scanner receiver, but I've got the ability to do that. I suddenly realized I should be doing that. When you see a ordinary television signal on a spectrum analyzer, 1.25 megs below the low end of the channel, you see this great big strong video signal, the carrier for the video. You see the modulation on there for the 60 cycle, approximately 60 cycle sync pulses, and approximately 1500 KC horizontal sync pulses, 60 cycle vertical sync pulses. You'll also see quite a bit of spectrum. Up until you get to 3.5 megs above, that's where the chrominant subcarrier is. 4.5 megs above the video carrier, you've got the audio carrier. So it's got a very distinctive look to it when you look at an ordinary, what's called NTS signal, NTSC signal, National Television Standards Committee or Selection Committee, I forget which it's called. The new digital signal looks like what they call Bart Simpson's haircut. On a spectrum analyzer, it just looks like broadband grass. It's got a very steep skirt on the low end, goes up to a flat top of grass, and a very steep skirt on the high end. And that's it. Buried in there, 600 KC from the low end, and 630 KC from the high end, 630 KC from the low end, is a very weak pilot signal. And unless you set your spectrum analyzer with very narrow scanning, you won't even see that pilot signal. So on a television set, the screen just stays blank as if nothing was there, and that's it. It's a highly digitized signal, Bill. Let me drop for a second. And as you probably know, February 17th, at on 2009, probably at midnight, on the beginning of that day, all analog television transmissions will cease to exist. For a person who's properly equipped today, I hear tell there's a large number of